From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, September 15th, 2016. And on this day, the Maine Board of Environmental Protection is again considering new mining rules that are drawing strong opposition from around the state. Children's advocates in Maine are concerned about the number of kids being expelled, not from school, but from preschool. And a community of African migrants breathes new life into some old Maine farmland. Those stories and much more after this. This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th. kvcc.me.edu. I'm Barbara Caridi. Just breaking now, the U.S. Coast Guard has awarded Eastern Shipbuilders of Florida the contract for the first of its new offshore cutters to replace its aging fleet. As Mal Leary reports, that's bad news for Maine's Bath Iron Works and its workers.
Eastern Shipyards of Florida beat out BIW and a Louisiana shipyard for the contract to build the first of what is expected to be 25 new cutters to replace the aging Coast Guard fleet. Maine's congressional delegation lobbied hard for BIW, but analysts had said BIW's higher costs, mostly for energy, could play into the decision. BIW President Fred Harris said in January of 2015 that as many as 1,200 manufacturing workers at the yard, that's about 35% of its workforce, could be laid off if BIW did not win the contract. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
For the third time in recent years, the Maine Board of Environmental Protection is considering new mining rules that are drawing strong opposition from around the state. Similar rules have twice been rejected by the legislature, but as Susan Sharon reports, staff from the department say the changes are needed to address gaps and inconsistency in the existing law.
The rules are seen as paving the way for New Brunswick-based J.D. Irving Limited to develop a mine near Bald Mountain in Arista County. The company has touted the plan as a way to create hundreds of jobs. But Nick Bennett of the Natural Resources Council of Maine says there are more than just a few problems with the plan and the rules. For one thing, he says, the Bald Mountain site is not appropriate for mining.
Metals like copper, zinc, gold, and silver are often found in a lattice of iron sulfide, and it's the sulfur in the iron sulfide that's the problem. If you dig that stuff up and expose it to air and water, it creates sulfuric acid.
Bennett says the sulfuric acid then runs off into the groundwater and surface water, killing fish and other aquatic creatures. It's called acid mine drainage, and it can also leach out dangerous heavy metals such as arsenic, which Bennett says is present in high amounts on Bald Mountain, along with high amounts of sulfur.
In sites out west, you can find problems with severe acid mine drainage in ore bodies that have 1 or 2% sulfur. The Bald Mountain ore body has up to 50% sulfur. So this digging up this ore body and exposing it to air and water is a recipe for an environmental catastrophe.
I just want to remind the board and the audience of the reason we've brought this before the board again.
Speaking at a public hearing on the proposed rules Thursday, Deputy DEP Commissioner Melanie Loizum says there is a metallic mineral mining rule in place, but it's out of sync with a 2012 law passed by the legislature. Because the two conflict with each other, Loizum says her agency has a lot of room for discretion if there's ever a permit application. She says the proposed rules are a way to establish clear standards that don't exist right now.
I would argue that the rule changes we are proposing are more protective of Maine's environment than our current situation. Leaving our rules as they are is not a positive environmental outcome.
But critics say the proposed rules don't require mining companies to pay enough money up front to cover the costs of a potential mining disaster. As an example, Representative Ralph Chapman of Brooksville points to the partial remediation effort being undertaken in his own town, where the former site of the Callahan mine has been declared a Superfund site. Chapman says cleanup costs have recently been revised. upward.
Rather than $23 million, the estimate is now $45 million, of which $4.5 million come from Maine taxpayers, at the current rate of about $500,000 a year.
In addition, there's concern that the proposed rules could put pristine rivers and streams on Bald Mountain and other parts of Maine in jeopardy. Matthew Scott, the former chair of the Maine Board of Environmental Protection and a retired chief biologist for the DEP, says the area around Bald Mountain contains 90% of the remaining habitat for eastern brook trout in the Northeast.
So I think we should do everything possible to protect the species. We should not be developing rules to encourage mining in those habitat areas. And therefore, mining of these habitats is highly risky to the survival of the species.
If the board approves the rules, the legislature will take them up once again in January. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Meanwhile, President Obama today announced the creation of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts National Monument off the coast of Cape Cod. Patrick Scahill of Connecticut Public Radio reports.
Deep-sea coral, endangered whales, sea turtles, those are just a few of the things the White House says will now be protected under the order signed by the president.
You know, I always describe it as climbing mountains from the top down.
Peter Oster is a senior research scientist at Mystic Aquarium. He's explored the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts firsthand, using underwater robots and by sitting in submarines.
We're not looking at these in black and white stippled diagrams from scientific journals alone anymore. We can see these in color and high-definition video, and you can tune in on the web. So I think that there's a confluence of both our ability to work in these places and then in real time or in near real time distribute these to an interested public.
Oster says that confluence has helped to kickstart public and political interest in preserving spots underwater. Last month, President Obama expanded a marine national monument off the coast of Hawaii, creating the world's largest marine protected area. This new zone is about 150 miles off the coast of Cape Cod. It's sized about the same as Connecticut, and because of the designation, recreational fishing will be allowed, but commercial fishing won't be. Bob Vanas, with the fisheries industry group Saving Seafood, opposes the measure. He says the canyons are so deep, fishermen really couldn't get in there anyway.
Why is it necessary to take this action if fishing for species such as red crab, swordfish, tuna, squid have all taken place over these locations for years?
Lobster and red crab fisheries have 7 years to comply with the measure. The move will also prohibit any underwater drilling or mining. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Patrick Scahill in Hartford.
Maine Governor Paul LePage, a Republican, has reacted strongly to President Obama's national monument designation southeast of Cape Cod. In a written statement, the governor says that the designation demonstrates the president's disregard for the transparent, science-based processes used to manage the nation's valuable marine resources and a callous disregard for the fishermen whose livelihoods depend on the area. Meanwhile, a $500,000 fine could be in the works for Maine telephone provider Fairpoint Communications. Staff at the Public Utilities Commission are recommending the penalty for the company's failure to meet service quality benchmarks from the summer of 2014 through all of 2015. Low points included what staff called vastly exceeding metrics for clearing network troubles in a day or less. Other failures included slow response times for service and installation requests. Public advocate Tim Schneider says Fairpoint needs to be held accountable.
Landline service is not a competitive priority for Fairpoint, and so they are not going to invest in it unless they're compelled to.
Fairpoint has not responded to a request for comment today. In filings, the company variously blames the problems on cyber attacks, storms, and a union strike. The company ultimately claimed that some of the service standards were unreasonable and unobtainable. The recommended $500,000 penalty will now be considered by the full commission. And Maine appears to be following a national trend of economic improvement and rising household incomes, along with a drop in the poverty rate. That's according to the Census Bureau, which released 2015 data for Maine and other states today. James Mayall of the Center for Economic Policy says the data show that median income in Maine is up.
median income went from about 49,500 in 2014 to 51,500. So an increase of about $2,000. And that represents a 4% increase.
But the national increase was 5.2%. Mayall says that while Maine's economy is improving, it's happening at a slower rate than for the nation as a whole. The same holds true for the official poverty rate. Maine's rate went down slightly, while the national rate decreased by 1.2%. Mayall says when the numbers are adjusted for inflation, they show that Mainers are still not back to pre-recession income levels. Maine's political arena was a busy place today. Hillary Clinton's running mate, Tim Kaine, is making a visit to the state today for a private fundraiser. Steve Missler has more.
Kaine is expected to arrive at Portland International Airport later today and attend a private fundraiser this evening. It's not yet clear if the U.S. Senator from Virginia will hold any public events while he's in Maine. Kaine's stop here will follow a visit to New Hampshire. Maine and the Granite State are shaping up as battlegrounds in the presidential contest. Polls show a tightening race between Clinton and Republican nominee Donald Trump. And three recent surveys show Trump performing well in Maine's 2nd Congressional District, suggesting that he has a shot at picking up at least one of Maine's four electoral votes. Such a split has never happened here. Maine is one of just two states that divides its electoral votes based on a candidate's performance in each of the state's two congressional districts. Democratic presidential candidates have dominated the state for nearly 30 years. The last Republican presidential candidate to take Maine was George H.W. Bush. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Meanwhile, the Maine Chiefs of Police Association has come out in support of Question 3, the November ballot initiative that would expand background checks for gun sales in Maine. At a press conference this morning in Gorham, the association's executive director, Robert Schwartz, said Maine law now requires commercial gun dealers to conduct background checks on buyers, but that's not enough.
There's been a loophole in the Maine law, and it's easy for dangerous people to buy guns from strangers they meet online with no background checks and no questions asked. Question 3 would close the loophole requiring background checks for all gun sales.
An unknown number of private gun sales take place in Maine every year through sites like Uncle Henry's and armslist.com. Research by supporters of Question 3 estimates that there are about 3,000 unlicensed gun sales every year. The Police Chiefs Association says expanding background checks to private sales won't solve gun crime on its own, but it says it's an important tool in efforts to end gun crime and the movement of illegal guns. Opponents to the expanded background checks say they would make it harder for law-abiding citizens to get guns while doing nothing to prevent criminals from getting them. Both sides of the Question 3 campaign are attracting lots of out-of-state money. On the pro side, the campaign has gotten most of its funding from Every Town for Gun Safety, a gun control group founded by Michael Bloomberg. The National Rifle Association is backing the effort against Question 3. And a coalition of Maine business and education leaders today urged voters to reject a ballot question that would increase education funding. As Patty White reports, the Maine State Chamber of Commerce and others say schools do need more funding, but Question 2 is the wrong solution.
If Question 2 is approved, it would add a 3% income tax to those who earn more than $200,000 a year. The president of the Maine State Chamber, Dana Connors, says that would give Maine the second highest marginal tax rate in the country. And the $160 million that would be raised, he says, would exacerbate the state's unfair funding distribution for education.
As more than one-third of the state's local school districts would receive zero additional dollars raised from this new tax.
But John Kaczynski of the campaign Stand Up for Students says Question 2 will help communities that are currently being shortchanged.
Those property taxes in those communities, whether it's Cape Elizabeth or Lewiston, Oxford County or Somerset County, the property taxes are being used right now just to fund the state's inability or unwillingness to fund education properly.
For more than a decade, Maine has failed to meet an obligation to fund 55% of K-12 education. Kaczynski says Question 2 will fill the gap. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Coming up, Maine advocates for children are concerned about the number of kids being expelled from preschool. And we meet a community of African migrants who are bringing some old farmland in Maine back to life. More than 10% of Maine's teachers and child care providers have expelled students as young as 3 from their programs due to challenging behaviors like hitting, pushing, and biting. That's according to a new survey from the Maine Children's Growth Council. As Robbie Feinberg reports, advocates for children in Maine are concerned about what the statistics mean for those kids and their families.
State Senator Kathy Breen asked for the survey, which was conducted by the National Center for Children in Poverty. Breen says she had heard a few stories before on expulsions of preschoolers and kindergartners, but the study made her see just how widespread the problem is.
That's pretty stark information.
The study found that challenging behaviors, such as hitting and pushing, were found in 92% of pre-K classrooms. And they often come from children with family issues, including substance abuse, domestic violence, and homelessness. For kids who do get expelled, more than half can't find another child care provider, or they end up in an unregulated setting that isn't licensed by the state. Peter Lindsay, the co-chair of the Maine Children's Growth Council, says the state needs to figure out how to support providers and families to make sure those behaviors are handled properly before they escalate.
How do we support providers, support teachers, support families, and work with families and providers so that the child doesn't have to leave, that they can stay in an educational setting and child care setting that's appropriate for that child?
One solution that's shown promise is Connecticut's system of early childhood mental health consultations. The program sends consultants to any child care setting in the state. Those consultants give training to providers and connect them with parents to work together through a problem instead of jumping to punishment. Senator Kathy Breen says she's interested in a number of ideas, including those consultations. She says she hopes to have a comprehensive policy to combat expulsions ready for deliberation by the next legislative session in December. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And in this turbulent political year, we've been exploring the stories of immigrants and their families in Maine. Today, we take you to Lewiston, where a community of African migrants is writing another chapter in the story of Maine as they breathe new life into old farmland. Jennifer Mitchell has this report.
It's an unusually hot, hazy, and humid day as the sun beats down on an old hayfield in Lewiston, Maine. The grass is dry, brown, and overgrown. 100 years ago, this field would have been lush and green and dotted with dairy cattle. It also sounds different today. A group of men, women, and children is celebrating in the middle of this 30-acre field, which they've just acquired. They are African migrants, mostly from Somalia, and they've come to turn this hayfield into a vegetable farm, producing food for the migrant community and for local sale. And the people who work the land are rewriting their own stories.
My name is Omasombo Katuka.
Omasombo, as he prefers to be called, arrived in the country about 6 years ago to escape one of the bloodiest civil wars the world has seen in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where some estimates put the death toll at more than 5 million. Millions more Congolese men and women have suffered war crimes, including mass rapes and the displacement of whole communities, despite a peace treaty in 2003. In those days, Omasombo was a teacher, but as threats grew, he became scared for his family's safety and fled with them to Tanzania. From there, he came with a wave of immigrants to resettle in Nashville, Tennessee, where he got a night job in a hospital laundry. But he didn't like the city. He'd heard about Lewiston and its growing community of African refugees. The family eventually made it to Maine, and he says they plan to stay here and pursue farming, a skill he picked up at the refugee camp.
I feel good because I'm in peace with my family. Here, you have a lot of support. That one, they help community. When you have some idea, they can help your idea grow up.
And are you a citizen yet, or are you working on a path to citizen?
I'm a citizen yet. I'm already.
How long have you been a citizen?
Like around 6 months ago.
So new, you are a new
citizen, America. Yes.
As a new citizen, Alma Sombo says he's not sure if he will vote in the upcoming election or how he might vote. He says he's been so busy trying to make a success of his farm to pay too much attention. At the moment, Alma Sombo farms about a quarter acre just over the town line in Lisbon with the New American Sustainable Agriculture Project, which provides land and opportunities for newcomers and refugees like him. For now, he's focusing on corn and African eggplant, which looks more like a lumpy tomato than the purple vegetable found here. Alma Sombo says growing eggplants and anything else in Maine has required some adjustment.
The only problem is here the season is too short. In Africa, the season is so long. We can't grow any time.
The majority of the people at the gathering to bless this new land are Somali Bantus. Men wear embroidered hats called takiyas, and the prevailing dress for women are the colorful shash and garbasar. Those are the headscarves and shawls that fulfill the Islamic requirement of modesty in dress. The air is redolent with spices from the little meat-filled pastries known as sambusas. The paperwork says the new acreage is owned cooperatively by four Somali Bantu farmers, and it gives their names. But given the communal nature of the immigrant farming community, it's hard to say that the land actually belongs to anyone. It's an important thing to understand about Somali culture, says Hussein Mukhtar, a Lisbon-based farmer who is helping out with a new farm site. Multiple people will work the land side by side, plant it, weed it, carry water by hand until a well can be dug, and they'll share in the harvest.
Family and friends are important in our culture and religion, so that's why we came together and, you know, to live and support each other.
That's the way many remember it back in Somalia. Mukhtar says he thinks on those early years when things were still peaceful, with warm nights in their village beside a river, fishing trips, and rows of corn and sorghum tended by the community.
When the civil war happened in 1992 or in 1990s, we left the country and we came to Kenya.
Mukhtar describes himself as about 32. He spent most of his youth in a Kenyan refugee camp before following the growing tide of migrants toward Maine. Here, he says, he will stay because with the farming opportunities, he can be what his farming ancestors wanted him to be.
This is not something we just started. It is started from generation to generation. So our great-grandparents choose for this hard work to make our living and also help other communities around.
Mukhtar has been a citizen of America for a few years now, and he says he's looking forward to voting in the upcoming presidential election. He won't say who he's planning to support, but he says he is frustrated by some of the political rhetoric surrounding not just immigrants, but Muslims as well.
We are from a country where has a civil war. We don't want to get into a fight. For us coming here, we feel like safe and home.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
What fair weather clouds populated the sky today will quickly vanish by sunset, and as the full moon rises, temperatures will tumble. By dawn, upper 30s in the mountain hollows to the upper 40s along the south coast with valley fog. Tomorrow, simply splendid, a nearly unblemished blue sky, upper 60s to mid-70s, coolest far north and the immediate coast. Saturday will feature the last dry day for a while. Down East Maine, sunny. Bright sunshine will fade during the afternoon throughout the remainder of the state, actually becoming overcast along the Quebec border by mid-afternoon. 70s to near 80, warmest interior southwest. Sunday will be rather soggy, yet I am not ready to advertise a total washout. It will be mostly cloudy and humid with scattered showers, 70s for all. Monday and Tuesday will bring incremental drying, and temperatures will be unseasonably warm. Highs will range from the upper 60s north to the upper 70s south. By Wednesday, sunshine should be in control for all but the far north, temperatures still well above normal. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public Broadcasting.
And that's the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, September 15th, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Fred Bever, Mal Leary, Steve Missler, Robbie Feinberg, Patty White, Jennifer Mitchell, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.